Oh, diddly. All right. So we're about to jump into the conversation we have or having this hour. Let me remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Now, we want to welcome you all back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This morning, we're spending our full time on the air discussing the issue of reparations. Ta-Nehisi Coates, the national correspondent for The Atlantic, who wrote the book The Beautiful Struggle about his life growing up in Baltimore with his father, Paul Coates, and his whole family, wrote this piece, The Case for Reparations, in The Atlantic magazine. And it has been reigniting this discussion of reparations in this country. And before we jump into our debate and discussion on what Ta-Nehisi wrote and on the whole issue of reparations, I want to present you with a conversation I had with Ta-Nehisi Coates on Friday.
The question of housing is one of the major problems this country faces. By and large, blacks live in substandard housing. Those who manage to fight their way out of it frequently pay a large penalty to do so.
I came from Birmingham, Alabama, but I came to Chicago for a better living and a job. I bought here, this house, in 58. It ain't nothing to brag about, but it's mine.
My name's Clyde Ross. I was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi. I bought this house in 1958.
I moved in this house in 1957. It was mostly a white area. And when they said that the niggers was coming, they didn't say black, they said the niggers was coming. And they just start moving away.
So now the author himself is here, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and we welcome you to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And so starting this piece off on reparations that you did, we just heard the voice of Clyde Ross and others in North Lawndale. And you use this as really kind of the springboard to get into the large conversation of reparations. Talk about why you started there and what this means and what the connections are.
Well, you know, I talked about this a bit on the blog. I came to reparations from a roundabout way. Analyzing and thinking about many of the problems of racism, problems of white supremacy, the problems afflicting the African-American community. And it became pretty clear to me that there was something, you know, about our past, about ourselves that we weren't quite honestly facing. And, you know, once I came to the concept of reparations, you know, I'm old enough to remember some of the past conversations about reparations and how, you know, hot it was for a little bit, you know, in the early 2000s and the late 90s. And I was thinking about, you know, often the arguments that are made against reparations, you know, whether, you know, they're real or not, whether they're substantial or not. And one of the primary ones is that, well, all the people who deserve reparations are actually, in fact, dead. Now, you can, you know, deal with whether that's a valid argument or not, but it was quite clear to me that, and I think anybody with any knowledge of African-American history understands this, that the crimes committed against black people during the era of white supremacy do not end in 1865, and in fact continue at least for the next 100 years. And so, you know, it was pretty clear to me early on that I could find a living person, I could find plenty of living people who we could build a case around, that they themselves, alive right now in front of you, are deserving of reparations. So I started with Mr. Clyde Ross.
And that was an interesting place to start, and I'm going to come back to that. I mean, because when you made that argument, you make the argument that we don't know George Washington, but we remember the great painting of George Washington, and mm-hmm. and that we weren't around World War I, but we're still paying those pensions, and there's this connection to our past. We have to deepen it. We can't tear it asunder. We can't make it not part of the discussion.
Right. Well, the state itself, I mean, the government would be impossible if government was simply, you know, limited to the natural life of individuals. In all aspects of policy, we understand this. When, you know, politicians want to have a conversation about the national debt, they talk about, well, what are we leaving to our children? When folks want to have a conversation about climate change and global warming, they say, well, what sort of world are we leaving for our children? There's some understanding that there is continuity in American society, in American life and American government that extends from before our natural lives and afterwards. On July 4th coming up, we will, you know, celebrate the independence of this great country. The fact that, you know, we weren't there when the Revolutionary War was fought is not an argument against, you know, at least it's not one that's often made, against celebrating on July 4th. And, you know, the argument I try to make in the piece is either you have to accept America or you don't. You don't. You can't call yourself an American. You can't call yourself a patriot and only accept the flattering portions of America, much like you can't be in a marriage and only accept the flattering portions of your spouse or your partner. We wish, right? Many of us wish. Our wives wish so.
Yes. Amen to that. But if the housing piece, and that is part of one of the subtexts of the piece that you've written here for The Atlantic, so is this quote, because it runs through it. Now, let me read the quote and say who said it, and we can talk about why it's so significant to you and what it says. Mm-hmm. The two great divisions of society are not the rich and poor, but white and black. And all the former, the poor as well as the rich, belong to the upper class and are respected and treated as equals. So said John C. Calhoun, South Carolina senior senator, in the Senate, on the Senate floor in 1848.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to recognize who John C. Calhoun is. I mean, he's just not just a, you know, another random senator of South Carolina. He's considered one of the great statesmen, you know, in American history. And you know, one of the things I wanted to clarify is that there are all sorts of conversations out there that are really, really important about the about class, you know, about the continuance of the class line, about inequality in America. You know, if you put, you know, race and racism aside, you know, that's a conversation we would be having anyway. But there's a very different conversation that needs to be had. It's very, very old in our country, and that's a conversation about white supremacy, about the force of racism specifically in American life and in American history. And I wanted to make sure we could focus on that and understand that it's old. It's not new. It didn't, you know, come out of anywhere. And that, in fact, it's the result of policy. John C. Calhoun said that he was also a slaveholder. He was part of a group of people who were making sure that society was upheld the way he laid it out in that quote.
Yeah, I mean, you even, when you quote the former president of Yale in 1810, Timothy Dwight, I thought it was important. It made me think of Craig Stephen Wilder's book on Ebony and Ivy. Mm-hmm. Because here you had the Yale president being quoted about what this legacy of slavery means in terms of the debt owed, yet without the legacy of slavery, they may have not been at Yale.
Right. And yeah, and you know, I suspect he might have known that, you know. But you know, I think the important thing about that quote too is that, you know, it's this idea that, you know, reparations is somehow this sort of, you know, new idea that just propped up that people figured out, you know, 150 or 100 years after, you know, the actual crime was committed. People knew it was a crime in that time, and they knew it would be insane to liberate enslaved African Americans and then give them nothing. In fact, that's actually what happened. But people, you know, of moral conscience understood at that time that would be a deeply problematic thing to do.
So, this is such a well-researched piece. I mean, you spend a lot of time clearly doing a lot of background on this, and I can see this as the beginnings of a much larger piece, maybe a book. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised. But because of all that you pulled in to kind of write this, and I let's take a step back for a moment and just deal with the concept of reparations as you've outlined it here. But especially around when you talk about Conyers and House Bill 40 and why that has kind of never come to the floor, even as, no matter whether it's Democrats or Republicans in control of the House and the Senate. I mean, and so what about how deep that conversation is and what it means for now. So I'm saying, I mean, that I think because it's when you people say that word reparations, people just fly off the handle.
Yes, they do.
You know, as soon as they hear the word, rip up.
Right.
Boom.
Right. And I think, you know, what people will tell you is that has a lot to do with the actual practicality or impracticality about reparations. I don't think it does. I think it has to do with the fact that on some level, we know that, you know, the country we celebrate and the way we, you know, celebrate it put some of the more distasteful things that we've done in our history to the side. And you know, the main thing that I argue in that is that, you know, any sort of, you know, investigation of this country's history would quickly reveal that white supremacy, enslavement, housing segregation, job discrimination, Jim Crow, debt peonage, mass incarceration today. These are not, you know, when you start tracing these lines, these are not ancillary lines in American history. It is very, very difficult to imagine modern America without white supremacy. And I think that, like, you know, that makes our minds break a little bit because, you know, we have things that we love about this country. We love living in this country. Nobody's in, you know, any particular urge to leave. At least most of us aren't. And yet, at the same time, you understand that what makes you possible, what makes this country possible, is something deeply awful and something that, you know, is you know, so rarely openly and directly spoken about, that people get scared the moment you bring it up.
So, again, North Lawndale, I mean, you make the argument in your sentences that you write, but also throughout the piece, that the conditions, and let's talk about this for a minute, the conditions that you saw in North Lawndale, this neighborhood that was once a white and Jewish neighborhood that became a black neighborhood that then was working class black neighborhood that became torn into poverty and dislocation with old people still living there, you see an inextricable tie between the conditions of that neighborhood and the centuries and the way that black folks have lived in America for centuries and the relationship between black and white. You see a direct correlation and a line.
Yeah, and I would argue it's hard not to see it, in fact. I mean, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, when the protagonist of this story, Mr. Clyde Ross, comes to North Lawndale, or maybe just before he came, it was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. It was not, you know, it was not the greatest neighborhood in Chicago, but it certainly wasn't, you know, it hadn't sank to the levels of poverty and sort of, you know, desolation that it currently has. How did that happen and why did that happen? Well, if you consider the time period during which Mr. Ross bought his house during the mid-20th century, or thought he was buying his house during the mid-20th century, one would have to ask, how did, you know, American society view African-Americans who were trying to buy homes, who were trying to build wealth in much the same way as all other Americans were building? And so if you look at government policy, for instance, we find redlining, and we can look at a map of Chicago and see that a neighborhood like North Lawndale and other neighborhoods where African-Americans happen to live, and by the way, not even necessarily majority black neighborhoods, but just neighborhoods where African Americans happen to live were marked in red. And in the code of the FHA and the HOLC, that meant that the government would not insure loans in those neighborhoods, would not try to spur investment in those neighborhoods. So at the very time that our tax dollars were spurring, you know, investment in white communities, in, you know, the suburbs of Chicago, in areas of Chicago where white people live, they were actively using tax dollars paid, you know, in part by black people, by the way, to not do the same thing in African-American neighborhoods. So you take the government policy, but, you know, when you start looking at private policy, you see a similar sort of thing. So you can look at the Realtors Trade Association of the time, and you can look at the handbooks and the actual documents they have. And in a particularly, you know, I think a illustrative quote, the handbook argues against showing homes in, you know, neighborhoods that, you know, would destroy any sort of homogeneity, or in other words, showing homes to African Americans who might move into, you know, white neighborhoods. And the language that's used is very, very interesting. The kinds of people that realtors are told to avoid are pimps, madams, prostitutes, or, and this is used in synonymous right. fashion, an African-American or a Negro or colored person, whatever the language of the time was, who is, you know, of means, who has somehow gotten into his head that he should have the right to live around white people. So we have to understand that. What that's basically doing is equating black people who have been financially successful in this country with criminals. And when you understand that, when you understand the realtors were that way, when you understand that the government was that way, when you understand that the banks were, you know, basically following government policy in terms of how they went, the condition of North Lawndale is not a surprise at all.
And so when you create this conversation, if the conversation is created in America, tell me what you think John Conyers' bill, which now that he's back in the election, will probably win, John Conyers' mm-hmm. bill, H.R. 40 will do if it got the light of day, if it even got a chance to go on the floor of Congress.
I have no idea, but here's what I'll say. I think if it did get the light day, I think if it did get on the floor of Congress, which would mean some substantial number of congressmen had supported and had decided it was a good idea, that would mean that some, you know, significant portion of Americans, you know, had themselves developed some sort of insight into their country. So already, I think we would be, you know, on the road to being a better country. And I think if it did, I think, A, we would, you know, get a pretty good history lesson on who we were, and, you know, how we got to, you know, where we were, and what our debts are to the past, our ample heritage, as Dwight said, who used to be president of here. And I just think that would be tremendous. And here's a deeper thing. Here's a thing that I only allude to in the piece, but I think is very, very important. America's, you know, challenge around white supremacy and racism is one of many challenges. I mean, there are huge existential challenges that are very similar that we face. And the one I often think of is climate change. Here you have a situation where threat is far off. It doesn't seem immediate. And yet, you know, we know that in the time of our, you know, children and grandchildren, it's going to be a huge, huge problem. How can we ever motivate the political will to do something around a problem like that when we can't face a more obvious problem, that being racism, white supremacy, that's right here in our face right now? I think this has the ability to improve our very understanding of citizenship and patriotism in the first place.
Because when people fought in the civil rights movement for integration, for the end of segregation and integration, many people said in the movement in those days, integrate into what?
Right.
And it seems that part of the argument you're making here is that if we don't have this conversation, if we don't push this issue and start talking about what it means for America, we'll never have the society we can integrate into.
That's exactly it. That is precisely it. And just, you know, if I can, you know, make another parallel back to the civil rights movement in terms of talking about this. Much as the civil rights movement, you know, opened conversations, you know, in around women's rights, you know, eventually around gay rights, around all sorts of issues of what it meant to be a citizen of America, period. Reparations movement has the promise of doing the exact same thing, because at its core, what reparations is calling for is a candid look at American history and what that, you know, entails upon us. You know, what debts and credits do we have when we look at our balance sheet? And that's a question that doesn't just go to the question of white supremacy in America. It goes to all sorts of other issues mm-hmm. that are dogging us right now. So it has, you know, the profound ability to do something more than just say cut a check to black folks.
You know, you quote Lyndon Baines Johnson in this piece, and it's really interesting what you pushed in this part of the conversation. Here you have this Southern senator who became president of the United States of America, who is the one who signed the civil rights bills. Yeah. He's talking about the exceptionalism of black poverty.
Yeah. And one of the other things, you know, a quote that we didn't get in there is, as he says later in that speech, you don't just injure a man, bring him up to the finish line and say, up to the starting line and say, hey, now run with everyone else and pretend everything's okay. And, you know, for some reason, that's our notion of what, you know, equality should be in this country, that, you know, we should stop doing all the awful things that, you know, we used to do or semi, you know, sort of stop doing them. And then everything will be okay. You're talking about a group of people who have sustained, you know, 350 years of deliberate attempts to inhibit their success. You know, just restoring everybody up, you know, to the starting line and stopping the process of actively injuring them does nothing, you know, for the injury that they've sustained over that long period of time.
So let's make another connection here that you do, I think, so well in this piece. And I think because we don't think about it. And you had this critique of the New Deal and housing policies in the New Deal and the Social Security, and some great quotes that we'll try to get to here that you came out with around Social Security. But, you know, you can make that link, and you do in ways through the article, make a link between that moment in history and the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, I, you know, the thing to understand is, you know, I mean, progressives, you know, like to believe that, you know, their policy or our policies that we push out into the world are somehow free of the taint of white supremacy. And one of the, you know, arguments I'm trying to make is white supremacy is such a force in American history that it just haunts in everything. You know, even, you know, ostensibly, you know, noble efforts that we think about, like the GI Bill, right? You know, soldiers coming home, rewarding them, giving them a chance to, you know, improve themselves through education, through housing, and, you know, into the middle class of America, into the burgeoning middle class at that point of the mid-20th century. Well, guess who was cut out of that? African Americans. When you talk about Social Security and the erecting of a social safety net, unemployment insurance in its earliest forms, even welfare, which later, you know, became racialized, you know, all of these things were engineered in such a way to cut African Americans out of it. And you can see the line all the way up to, you know, the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, obviously was not written, you know, to cut African Americans, you know, out of it. But, you know, after the Supreme Court case, in fact, in the way that it's, you know, been employed, it does, because, you know, many of the states in the South where the majority of African Americans live, or a large percentage of African American lives, are opting out of the Medicaid expansion, which so many African Americans desperately need.
You know, there are some of the pieces in here, and I think they're important to talk about a bit, because I think that when we talk about the kind of existential parts of this, or the parts that have America to do their soul searching, you can feel it in some of the words, the way you describe it. I'm going to use the word, they sound emotional, but that's not what I'm saying, because it's not emotional. That puts it in a place I don't want to put it. But you write things like, about the black family. You say, in a time when telecommunications were primitive and blacks lacked freedom of movement, the parting of black families was a kind of murder. Here we find the roots of American wealth and democracy, in the for-profit destruction of the most important asset available to any people, the family. The destruction was not incidental to America's rise. It facilitated that rise.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, there's no, again, just to take it back a little bit, Americans often understand the period of enslavement as, you know, a bad thing done by a small group of people that probably should not have happened, but basically ancillary, not really important to America's rise. In fact, when you start looking at the map, it's very difficult to imagine America without enslavement. Virginia colony is settled, I believe, in 1607, 1609, something like that. By 1619, you have, you know, Africans being imported, enslaved to do the labor. And this is generally the truth of any, you know, place where any of the, you know, early colonies. When you start thinking about, I mean, just on a symbolic level, you know, the capital. When you think about President James Polk, you know, speculating on slaves while he was in the White House, you know, on a symbolic level, America is impossible without enslavement. But then on a real fiscal financial level, it also is, too. At the onset of the Civil War, property in man, as they called it, slaves, enslaved Africans, were the largest single asset in America. They were worth more, some estimate around $3.5 billion. And that was more than all of the collective productive capacity, all the banks, all the railroads, all the everything in America combined. Enslaved Africans were worth more than that. That's how big of a financial interest people were. The Mississippi Valley was home to more multimillionaires per capita than any other region in the country. The largest export in America in 1860, at the onset of the Civil War, was, guess what? Cotton. 60% of our exports were cotton. So you're talking about a large financial interest, and to imagine America without that, to take that out, not to mention, you know, all of the cultural contributions that came out of that period, you know, fortunately and unfortunately, is to imagine an entirely different America. It is not to imagine any sort of America, you know, as we know it. And you can't have that. You can't have enslavement without the destruction of black families. It's just that's what it is. The institution is in and of itself violent, a kind of war perpetrated against African Americans, their communities, their families, their bodies, their individuality, their humanity itself.
And the violence didn't end.
No. The violence did not end. Following the Civil War, what we have is the largest, you know, wave of domestic terrorism in American history. And for the most part, with the exception of, you know, a few short years during Reconstruction, the country turned its back. Such to the extent that the Senate actually had to enact an apology at the late date of 2004 for effectively doing nothing during the epoch of lynching. And, you know, such are the ghosts of white supremacy that two senators abstained from that apology. Those two senators represented the great state of Mississippi, which endured more lynchings than any other state in the country.
I was going to say unbelievable, but no, it's not.
No, it's not. It's detestable, but not unbelievable.
I'm talking with Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent for The Atlantic, and author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. I'm talking to him about his cover story for this month's Atlantic magazine, The Case for Reparations. We have to take a very brief break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm here talking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his latest piece, The Case for Reparations. It's the cover story on this month's Atlantic Monthly. Ta-Nehisi Coates is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. Well, there's a quote you have from Eric Hobsbawm, the historian, says, whoever says Industrial Revolution says cotton.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in many degrees, I'm actually underestimating the case because what, you know, if you take, you know, if you remove enslavement from the equation, like if you think about this in terms of the Atlantic world, in terms of the diaspora, you start talking about the Caribbean islands, you start talking about Brazil, you start talking about the Atlantic world itself, you just can't, you can't imagine it. You can't imagine any quote unquote, you know, new world or as we call it, the Atlantic world without enslavement. That's how it happened.
So, yeah, I think that's an important point. The important points to make in this, and you kind of also make this an argument here. I guess there's so many pieces that you can take from what you've written, and just create whole discussions out of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one point you talk about the instituting broad class struggle for anti-racist struggle. Progressives hope to assemble a coalition by changing the subject. And this is one of the politics of racial evasion are seductive. You're right. But the record's mixed. So, but part of the problem is for some people, and one of the people will be on our show after this conversation, and people making these arguments back and forth, is that they're so intertwined you can't separate them.
You can certainly separate them as a problem. I think so. You know, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, if we look at the statistics, for instance, some of the sociological research I point to on there is not just about poor black people, but relatively, you know, quote unquote, high earning black people. For instance, the sociologist Patrick Sharkey,
right,
at NYU has shown in his research, and we quoted in the piece, that in the African-American family that earns $100,000 a year basically lives in a neighborhood that is the equivalent of a white family that owns only $30,000 a year. It's very important, you know, that we separate the problems of, you know, poverty, which are important. It's a significant conversation to have, from the conversation and the problems of racism. African-American college graduates still have employment opportunities that are less than white college graduates. That's a problem of racism. And the problem of poverty is it's a different animal entirely. Well, not entirely. It's a related animal, I should say. But those issues are worthy each and of themselves of conversations.
So do you think the conversation that you're setting forth here in the piece that you've written, let me just use one of your own words, this series of words here, this is what it seems to be doing. To ignore the fact that one of the oldest republics in the world is erected on a foundation of supremacy, you talk about is to cover the sin of national plunder with the sin of national lying. I jumped a little bit in that sentence, but that's basically what you said. Let's talk a minute then about what this conversation that you think has to take place means.
Well, you know, as I started out, as I was saying earlier, I think it's really, really important that we think of this as a chance to have a revolution of consciousness. That we think of this as a chance to have, you know, a reckoning with how we think about, you know, ourselves as citizens of America. There is one method of citizenship and, you know, patriotism, one species of citizenship and patriotism that says, you know, my country, right or wrong, you know, everything America does is great. You know, maybe not, you know, to give it, I guess, its full due. Maybe everything it doesn't is great. Isn't great, but in the end, America is right. In the end, we'll triumph. In the end, everything will be okay. I'm pitching a kind of patriotism that, again, is much more akin to the kind of love that, you know, we have for our children, for our parents, for our relatives, for our friends, where we do love them. We do love them. We do think overall that they are good. But if we love them, we also are capable of having very, very candid conversations with them and being very, very direct. And when they're messing up, you know, we are very good. You know, if we're being good friends, if we truly do love them, about speaking to them about that in no uncertain terms. You know, not camouflaging, you know, not acting like, you know, we're talking about one thing when we're really talking about something else. That's how you behave when you care about people. And similarly, you know, that's how, you know, I believe you should behave when you claim to care about your country. When you see people, for instance, waving a Confederate flag, as I talk about in the piece,
yes, right,
and then talking about patriotism, I don't know how those two things go together. I don't know how, you know, you wave the flag of a group of people who attempted to erect a republic based on slaveholding, an attempt to destroy American democracy. and then claim to be, you know, claim to love America. You know, I don't know how you claim to love America when, you know, you're you know, scarfing hot dogs and hamburgers on the 4th of July and happy to take the credit, you know, for the things that you believe America did right, but don't want to be around when we have to have a conversation about the things that America did wrong. That's not friendship. That's not love. And that's not patriotism.
As Clyde Ross said in your piece, the reason the man who lives in North Lawndale, who bought the house there, left Mississippi, and his story is amazing in this piece. He said, the reason black people are so far behind now is not because of now. It's because of then.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, what else is there to add? I mean, that's it.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, I deeply appreciate you taking the time with us today here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Mark, thank you so much for having me back here again.
We are going to, it's obviously linked to the case for reparations on our website by Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's also the author of The Beautiful Struggle. That conversation we had with him and his father will also be linked in the same place. You can hear that again as you did in the show a few weeks back when we replayed it. Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much.
Thank you.